Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
This is Free Range with Von Miller, the podcast where I step outside the lines and I take you with me. Each week, we're talking everything from the biggest stories around the league to the biggest stories off the field. This isn't your average sports podcast. This is game meets culture, locker room meets living room, and no topic is off limits. So if you're into good conversations that ruffle a few feathers, join me every Wednesday and follow Free Range with Von Miller everywhere you get your podcast.
Jake Volnick with you guys here on The Fan. Going to be joined by Ethan Sands, Cleveland.com here shortly. But before we do, I want to remind you that Browns OTAs are underway in minicamp just around the corner, and there are plenty of storylines at the quarterback position. Don't miss a minute of The Fan with the latest breaking news during your workday or on the go. Stream us at 92.3thefan.com or on your phone with the free Odyssey app. A lot to get into with a Cavs team that I just look at, and there's a lot that goes into this Cavs team in general, a lot that goes into last night that I think is a lot more simply put than a three-word phrase. We'll figure out if, again, our good friend, as we go out to the North Olmsted Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram hotline, Ethan Sands at Cleveland.com can sum it up a little bit more quickly. Ethan, how's it going, man?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I'm doing pretty well. I think the only way to start this interview is to ask you the question that all Cavs fans, I think, to this moment are probably still asking themselves. What happened in Game 4?
I think a reflection of what happened in Game 2, right? A destructive collapse of the season, of the series, and then you feel like you're going to get everybody back in Game 3. You do that. You come back. You get a win. And then another injury plagues the team. And you see how Donovan Mitchell reacted at halftime. And the understanding is of this team that they feel like that they can come back from a 3-1 series deficit. But the reality of the situation is it feels like the will of this team has been broken. It feels like they have been through a lot throughout the course of this season, and we're continuing to see things being broken down into a very small factor that they continue to get to this April, May situation and cannot get over the hump. Last year, it was the Eastern Conference semifinals against the Boston Celtics. The year before, it was the first round against the New York Knicks. And here we are again in the Eastern Conference semifinals against the Indiana Pacers. So whether the team changes, doesn't feel like the whole narrative has changed for the Cleveland Cavaliers.
Ethan, is it fair to say that the Cavs, after getting that win in Game 3, being in control for pretty much the entirety of that game, got complacent in Game 4 and that showed through?
I don't think it could be labeled as complacency. I think there was always a level of desperation, especially knowing that they were still down 2-1 and the history of a 3-1 deficit. They understood the complexity of having to come back from that. So I don't think there was any complacency. I just think there was a reality check that Rick Carlisle made some fantastic adjustments, some schematic adjustments that stifled the Cavs, and the Cavs weren't able to bounce back from that, even though that's what they've done all year, is make adjustments. And yet they've been out-coached, out-hustled, out-maneuvered, out-everything when it comes to this series so far.
We saw the 3-2 zone work so well in Game 3, and it was really what probably propelled the Cavs to their win, stifled Indiana's defense in that first half incredibly well. And then we sort of see it again last night. Indiana made some key adjustments. What actually changed between the Indiana offense from games 3 to 4 that allowed them to beat that?
instead of trying to attack Evan Mobley on the perimeter, they were able to find mismatches on the interior, whether that was against Jared Allen, but also an understanding that if you're going to run that 3-2 zone, there's likely two guards in the back playing safety with Evan Mobley at the top of that zone. So you either have Max Strus or Darius Garland, who's trying to be hidden, even though Kenny Atkinson, he said he wasn't going to hide Darius Garland. He put him in the back of that zone, and you guys got guys like Pascal Siakam and Miles Turner, who can not only stretch the floor, but can still also be dominant on in the painted area. So that's what they did. They were able to go after those mismatches and eliminate what Evan Mobley was able to do, because the whole point of a 3-2 zone is to not have so much overhelp from what the Cavs have been doing. So leaving Evan Mobley on that island, you kind of also put your backcourt at a disadvantage who are trying to protect the rim, unfortunately, in that situation. And again, like I said, that's Rick Carlisle finding the nicks and crannies and allowing his team to be put in the best situation to be successful, whether that was shooting the ball or getting into transition or slowing the game down, even though we haven't seen that so much from the Pacers, but they were able to do it in game four and attack the painted area. And for me, that's the biggest nuance of this series is throughout the entire series up until game four, the Cavs had dominated the painted area, but that wasn't the case in game four. And Jared Allen and Evan Mobley, I mean, they were just bad, man. I mean, Jared Allen had one field goal attempt throughout the entire course of the game. Evan Mobley was non-existent on the offensive end, and they weren't on the rebounding end either, and they weren't getting on the board. So I think it was indicative of how the series had shifted and had changed into the momentum of the Indiana Pacers.
So I saw a lot of people pointing to, obviously, it felt like the Cavs just sort of got, you know, out-physicaled again. Everything was going the way the Pacers, you talk about the big man down low. Hey, did you look at the Benedict Mathurin ejection with the back and forth between him and DeAndre Hunter is a sort of turning point for the physicality in that game?
It was supposed to be for the Cavs.
Right.
I wrote about this for Cleveland.com. I said, like, that was supposed to be the moment that the Cavs took an advantage, right? Because the Indiana Pacers lost Benedict Mathurin, who was the leading scorer for them in game three, and the Cavs got away with one, keeping DeAndre Hunter on the floor. So now you're playing against some of the rotation players that, as while Rick Carlisle had used that throughout the series, that necessarily wasn't who he wanted to go to in those moments. So at that moment, the Cavs should have pushed on the throttle. Instead, Darius Garland said after the game that that's when the physicality for them decreased. Obviously, they had a good amount of players in foul trouble, and that didn't help them at all. But it's an understanding of taking the moment and responding to it. And the Indiana Pacers in that moment showed so much poise, composure, and an understanding that that was a turning point in the game, but they turned it on their own. They turned it on its side for them. And it was an important factor for the Cavs to realize that they were going to have to bounce back, but they just didn't.
I think a lot of these times, and Ethan Sands with us on the North Olmsted Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline, I think a lot of the times, at least from a fan perspective, knowing that it's a team game, but a lot of people can walk away from a game and go, wow, that was a really bad performance from, you know, player X, coach X, and I think that, you know, you could pin this loss on them. Again, in the fan eyes, I think we know in the media, like, you can't really do that. It's a team game. It's never one player. But this felt like a game that you walk away as a Cavs fan going, I don't even know a player that you could pin that loss on, or that you could pin it necessarily on Kenny Atkinson alone. Is this as total as a team loss as you're ever going to see?
Yes, 100%. Because I think it showed you that, like, Evan Mobley was the piece that took them to game three, took them to a different level, and obviously Donovan Mitchell was phenomenal in game three as he has been all series. But when you lose Donovan Mitchell, even when you had Donovan Mitchell in that first half, you guys are down 44, 41 points at halftime, right? So I think when you talk about team loss, and that's what we talk about when it comes to breaking the spirit of the team, you felt like there was nothing you could have done to change the outcome of the game. And I think that's draining. I think that's debilitating. And I think that's something that the Cavs will have to take a look at even when the series ends, whether that's in game five, game six, or game seven.
Ethan, obviously, we look at halftime. We watch Donovan, and the video resurfaces during the broadcast there in the third quarter. He reaches down at his ankle during warm-ups coming out of halftime. Doesn't play in the second half. How much of that, after an MRI today revealing a little bit of a re-injury, how much of that is a cautionary tale for the Cavs to not overplay Donovan? Well, you're down 41, quite frankly. And how much of that is realistically Donovan Mitchell could possibly not play in a game five?
I just think he wants to be out there. Like, he is the will of this team. He is the most dominating force and arguably could have been deemed one of the best players in the entire playoffs throughout this portion of the playoffs. And I think it's really hard for him to have asked these guys, Darius Garland, Evan Mobley, and DeAndre Hunter, to come back and then not be out there for game five. So I feel like he'll want to be out there as much as he possibly can. But this is, again, we talked about it earlier on this show, the rewind to previous seasons. Looking back just to last year, Donovan's dealing with that knee injury throughout the Boston Celtics series and then re-aggravates a calf injury because of overexertion. And so we saw that in this instance as well. Obviously, he's dealing with the calf strain to start the series, and then he does so much that he re-aggravates the ankle injury that he had at the end of the regular season that saw him miss the last four games. So I don't think he wants to see a second season in a row come to an end with him on the bench. I think that would be demoralizing for him as somebody who has not gotten out of the conference semifinals and wanting to do that and understanding that his legacy is on the line, because there are going to be some hard conversations this summer if the Cavs cannot get out of this series, and it's looking really bleak.
If Donovan decides he can't go for game five, can the Cavs still pull off a win in that game without Donovan and actually close out a game, or is this series over at five games if Donovan doesn't play?
If Donovan doesn't play, the series is over.
Oof. That is, I can't disagree after the guy drops 40 in multiple games, and you watch the way that it played out last night even with him there, but I don't know. It seems like a tough way to go anyway. And Ethan, I'll ask you too, just to sort of be realistic with it, right? We all want to say, you look at a 3-1 lead, we've seen it done before in this city on a grander stage, obviously with the likes of LeBron, but down 3-1 already, what are the Cavs' chances of coming back?
I got asked this question the other day, and I think it's 10%. 10% chance that they pull off a comeback. Obviously, I think, as I said earlier, it hinges on Evan Mobley, because Donovan has dropped 40 in multiple games. You lost one of those games, you won one of those games. He dropped 30 points in game one, right? He's been averaging 30-plus points. So I think realistically, you need him to still have that productivity. He's able to play, but somebody else has got to do it. And Evan Mobley is the guy that can make the most impact on both ends of the floor. Obviously, Max Strus, aside from game four, has been really good for the Cavs shooting the ball. He's been their main three-point option. Sam Merrill has shown some life as well. He literally played 14 minutes in game four. I was surprised by that. So I don't know. I think the chances are extremely low, but I think the Cavs have shown that there is a possibility, even though it's slim, for them to make some adjustments to make a comeback. But it has to start with game five at Rocket Arena, then they have to go to Indy and get game six, and then they have to come back and get game seven. Because I think if you win two in a row, you feel real good about your chances in game seven, but you got to get there first.
Ethan Sands, Cleveland.com, with us on the hotline. Ethan, I see a lot of people, you know, reacting and saying different things after this game about after the season's over. As we go back and reflect on this series and the way that it looks like, how much of this can you chalk up to injuries going into next year? And how much of this is just the Cavs, quite frankly, not showing up when they needed to?
I think it's a little bit of both, but, like, we can't keep giving these cop-out answers for injuries, right? Because, obviously, the Pacers are healthy. Good for them. They somehow continue to find a way to be healthy in the playoffs. Maybe Kenny Atkinson talks to Rick Carlisle over the summer and figure out how they did that, because the Cavs did everything in their power to be healthy. But it's also just comes down to luck. But the Boston Celtics are playing through injuries right now. They're not playing all that great, but they're competing with the Knicks right now in the Eastern Conference semifinals as well. And the Knicks are also not 100%. And you just understand that injuries can't be the reason every year that you look to as a cop-out answer, as an excuse. But I think the understanding is for the Cavs is, once again, we feel like we have enough, but we can't show it if not everybody is playing to their full potential. And I think there's that double-edged sword with that. And it's an interesting conversation to look forward to this summer to figure out what the Cavs are going to be able to do, because we know that they're a second apron team. They could make some drastic moves. They could try and make some moves around the margins, veteran minimums, all these things. And I just think this roster looked so complete. 64 wins is nothing to sneeze at. But I think we have to take a deeper look into the playoff readiness of some of these players and the maturity of the Cavs, especially after yet another Eastern Conference semifinals flame out, if that's how it pans out.
Is there a real chance we go into this offseason, if they, especially if the Cavs go and drop this in five, that we get into a year at the back half of 2025 that does not include every member of the core four?
I think it's everything is on the table if they lose in five. I've heard different things throughout the organization. I've heard different things from other executives around the league. Some are saying that they understand how good the core four is. Other people are saying fireworks, right? Talking about how changes could be made. I'm going to say that everything is on the table for this team if they lose in five. The understanding is that this team won 64 games. They made franchise history on multiple different occasions this year, and they don't want to take that and go away from it. But they understand that the true goal for this entire season was the playoffs, and if they lose in five, then that was not a success. They wanted to at least get to the Eastern Conference Finals, and the real goal was beating Boston, and they're not even going to have a chance to do that if they lose in five.
Ethan, I'll get you out of here with this one. If the Cavs go through and win a game five, what adjustments need to be made in order to do so?
That's a loaded question, because we talked about how there was basically everything needs to be changed. I just think, like, you have to pick an area where you're going to be dominant, right? And that had been the painted area for a majority of this series, because Miles Turner and Pascal Siakam had been playing on the perimeter. And Jared Allen had 2 points, one field goal attempt, and two rebounds in game four. That's unacceptable. Evan Mobley had 10 points, five rebounds, and seven shot attempts. I still think we need more from Evan Mobley. He was 3 of 7 from the field, right? Dean Wade, 11 minutes, 3 points, three rebounds. Need more from him. I think DeAndre Hunter, 16 minutes, 5 points, four rebounds. We can go through the stats, but I think when you talk about domination, when you talk about being able to hang your hat on something, the defensive end has been that for the Cavs throughout the last 3 years, and I think they need to get back to that. That is what helped them win game three. Sure, the shooting was a little bit better, but I think their defensive effort, the hounding of Tyrese Halliburton, the turnovers that they forced, that was what allowed them to win that game. I think they need to focus in on that end of the floor, and if the shots come, the shots come. But they shot 40%. They shot above 30% from three-point range for the first time in game four. We saw how that panned out. You cannot just rely on the offensive end of the floor for this team. You have to rely on the defense, because it's what has gotten to you this far, and the playoffs have not been nice to you on the offensive end. So I think you have to take that into a reality check and go back to what has gotten you this far. And shout out to J.B. Bickerstaff, because maybe he was a little bit foresight on that one.
All right, Ethan, definitely a little bit of a shout out to J.B. As much as Cavs fans maybe not feeling the greatest about his time here, definitely a defensive side helped it. Ethan, as always, good stuff. I appreciate you carving out the time, sitting down with us, and I look forward to hopefully talking to you after an immaculate comeback win and before an Eastern Conference Finals.
Always good talking to you, Jake. Have a good rest of your day.
You too. Ethan Sands with us there on the North Olmsted Chrysler Jeep Dodge Ram Hotline. Check him out at cleveland.com. Always good stuff. Jake Volnick with you guys here on The Fan. Just got done talking to Ethan Sands over at cleveland.com. Really good stuff out of Ethan. And he laid it out to you pretty flat. Like, he threw a number on it. I threw him one of the odds. I was expecting basically a not good. He threw me 10% that the Cavs can complete a 3-1 series comeback. And Ethan, in a lot of ways, but much more descriptively and better thought out. So if you missed it, Odyssey Rewind feature 92.3thefan.com. Make sure you guys go back and listen to him when he joined us at 8 there. But it seemed like it was basically the same thing that I was alluding to, is that's just a loss. Like, everything went wrong in that game. It was a loaded loss of, well, everything you did just didn't work. Which is not a good sign. Not a good sign heading into a game five that is now officially a must win. And so are the next three and what you actually need to get to. But I don't know, just absolutely and entirely brutal. It kind of leaves me, we have to re-ask the question. I mean, we've been asking it throughout this series. I got to go to Jax, though. Jax, series over? Or do we actually have a series?
We have a series.
Oh, is that? Oh, now yeah. We have one.
We have a series, yeah.
So it is unover.
It's unover. No.
It's been reversed.
Yeah.
Okay, so now
it was over, yeah. Series is unover now. We have a series.
Restarted by the Pacers, if you would.
Yeah.
All right, just checking in, making sure. And kind of what I want to pose to you guys, obviously, it's slightly more seriously, but at 216-474-0092, are the Cavs dead? Series over or series not over? Because I again, just look at this right now, 3-1, I just don't know that this team's truly built for it. I mean, as bad as it is to lay that out there in that way, I just don't think they are. I think this is a team that can compete in close series, that can, if they get ahead, I'm confident that they'll close out series. I just don't know that I look at this team and go, yeah, they have the ability on a really good Pacers team that just absolutely demoralized you in that game to go out there, spark the ignition, and find a way to get three games straight. That's going to be very difficult to do. You've shown you can take a game in Indiana. Indiana's already shown they can take two in Cleveland. Have they seen this iteration of the Cavs? Not on your home floor, but it's going to be difficult to get there. This is not a LeBron and Kyrie. We can go back to 2016, remember how amazing that was, and obviously to cap it off with an NBA Finals and a Larry O'Brien, but it's not that same group. This team's going to have to put their head down, and you're going to need to see Indiana start to play down a little bit. Right? Because the Cavs are, obviously, it just comes down to you need to make your shots at some point. Like, they have just not been hitting open jumpers for basically the entirety of this round, the first four games of this series. They are dead last in three-point shooting across the remaining teams in the playoffs, and I don't think anybody would imagine it being any other way. But you got to do a whole lot more than just knock down shots, too. Like, you need the Pacers in a physicality sense to play down to the Cavs. And they have not in any way looked like they wanted to do that. I mean, we talked and we asked Ethan about the Benedict Mathurin foul, the flagrant two that he picked up on DeAndre Hunter. It should have been a momentum boost for the Cavs. If that in every way should have swung the momentum of the game. In an unnecessary play, Benedict Mathurin goes and takes a cheap shot on DeAndre Hunter. He gets ejected. DeAndre gets away with the shove back. Don't know how he got away with it, but he got away with the two-handed shove that knocked Mathurin to the ground. He gets away with it. You're up a player. You're up one of the most physical players that has been in this series, and somehow from that point on, doesn't really feel like it got much better. And I hear people say, oh, Cavs are a finesse team. Cavs are a finesse team. They're not, they say, a dominant physical team, which I can look up and down the roster and go, yeah, for the most part, you're probably right. But then you need to be able to finesse. There is no finesse from this team right now. It's bang your head into a wall until it works. And I don't mean physically, because obviously they haven't been doing that. But it's been bang your head into a wall until it works, because all they do are settling for jumpers and expecting them to go down. If you're going to be a finesse team, you have to be elite. You have to be able to shoot the ball at elite levels. Nobody has shown up in that department for the Cavs. Nobody has gotten to a point where they're shooting the three ball, you know, almost 50% from this series. Everybody's having a bad shooting series. And that's a game where you look at the Cavs, in a series where you're looking at the Cavs going, don't you have something else in the bag? Don't you have another way to get this done? I can look at the roster. I don't think they're void of players that can be physical. Right? Like, Donovan is obviously more of a finesse player in general, but he can be a little physical. DeAndre Hunter is capable of that. I think Ty Jerome, much more capable of that than he's been. And same with your two bigs in Mobley and Allen. Evan Mobley is not a naturally physical player. Defensive player of the year, he avoids fouls. He doesn't get into people's, sort of space. He does it with a long frame, really good timing. There needs to be times in this series where I see Evan Mobley crank up the physicality. It feels like I'm watching, hard contact every single time down the floor from the Cavs. It's not a knock on the refs, but then like small contact from the Cavs on the other side that turns into like an and one. You put your hand on the back of somebody going up for a layup, and that's a clear, blatant, easy call for the refs. Meanwhile, every time you try to go down low and you try to bulldog your way into the paint, you're getting bumped around and they're not calling it. I don't know that's something you can change in the course of a series, that you just absolutely figure out, oh, hey, we need to be doing that too. Because it's an entire mentality change. Unless the Cavs figure that out, or unless they figure out a way to actually go back to being one of the best shooting teams in the NBA, second best in the regular season, you're dead. They're not winning this series without an ability to find out, at bare minimum, one of those two things. You have to hit your shots in the playoffs. This needs to be where people rise to the level and elevate above the level expected to them. And quite frankly, yes, while still dealing with major injuries throughout the time here, and they've been missing key contributors, it feels a lot more that the Cavs have shrunk while the Pacers have elevated. I'm watching Andrew Nembhard. I'm watching Miles Turner become sharpshooters from beyond the arc in ways that they weren't in the regular season because they're elevating to the play. Something the Cavs have just not figured out how to do. Again, I don't want to just hammer it home, but you do. The Cavs need to be a much better team just shooting the ball and putting themselves in spots to be able to convert when the shots aren't going down. Offensively, they've been bad. Defensively, I don't want to say they got lazy in that game, but they kind of got lazy. In this entire series, aside from game three, their defense has been kind of lazy, and I'll give it to them for three quarters of game two. Everything that has branded this team to be what they are is everything that has not showed for almost every game in this series. Unless you find a way to get back to doing that and doing it at an absolute high level, you better get ready to talk about potentially trading the core four, even though I think it's absolute blasphemy. But those are the Cavs conversations we're heading towards. Again, 216-474-0092 if you guys want to jump in. Let's come back here in 5 minutes. Let's get to the station buzz. It's overtime with Jake Volnick on The Fan. Jake Volnick with you guys here on The Fan. We're going to get to the station buzz here in just a few minutes. But we're probably going to push Get a Grip back to 9:20. We'll react to the Guardians at 9 o'clock as they're getting ready to wrap up relatively shortly in Milwaukee. Fingers crossed if things go well. So we'll react to the Guardians coming up probably at 9, Get a Grip at 9:20. But I do want to hear the most pressing things said by our station's guests today, so why don't we get into it with the station buzz? All right, let's kick things off. Let's talk.
At Marisa's, we're all about great jeans. You know, the ones that fit you just right. The ones that go from work days to weekends and everywhere in between. The ones that simply make you feel good. Because you don't just wear jeans, you live in them. With 25 sizes, 5 lengths, and 6 denim brands, you've got options. And fit experts in every store to make jean shopping easier. Find great jeans starting at $29.90 in stores and at Marisa's.com.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $150 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$150 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
This is Free Range with Von Miller, the podcast where I step outside the lines and I take you with me. Each week, we're talking everything from the biggest stories around the league to the biggest stories off the field. This isn't your average sports podcast. This is game meets culture, locker room meets living room, and no topic is off limits. So if you're into good conversations that ruffle a few feathers, join me every Wednesday and follow Free Range with Von Miller everywhere you get your podcast.
Talk a little Browns. We haven't talked any Browns up to this point in the show. So let's start things with Ashley Bastock, Cleveland.com, on with Nick and JP on Afternoon Drive today. And she talked about the health of Jeremiah Owusu-Koramoah.
I mean, never say never. Like, I think that kind of announcement, an early retirement for, like, the player of JOK's caliber, I think everyone, but especially him, would have to be 110% sure at that point. But the thing with neck and spine injuries are obviously they are incredibly unpredictable. We don't exactly know even what his exact injury was. So that makes it harder. I mean, we know it was bad. Everyone obviously saw the compression on that hit in the Ravens game. So I'm certainly not surprised that this announcement came, because it was getting to a point where, like, okay, we haven't gotten any kind of update on this, and this is not a no news is good news situation, right? Like, you assume if he's going to be ready, we would have already known that.
Yeah, I saw some people on social media getting a little surprised that this happened. As I don't know that we should be surprised at all. I'm not sitting here calling JOK's career done by any means, but I think the Browns very much indicated that in the season coming up here in 2025, they were not expecting JOK to be back. They were fully prepared for JOK to be done for the year. I mean, you went out and drafted a linebacker at 33. You went out and acquired multiple linebackers. You re-signed Devin Bush, but maybe that went on the back burner for now. And you also went out and, you know, tried to acquire, what, Jerome Baker. And I think you went through and re-signed another linebacker, if I'm not mistaken, off the top of my head. Like, you tried to fill out this linebacker room very much. And for the future, and making sure that you have a guy there, if JOK returns, great. If not, they showed you they're clearly worried about the position. I don't think this is anything that should have caught somebody by surprise. I mean, we haven't seen JOK on a field. They refuse to give updates. I feel like, as Ashley laid out there, how no update isn't a good update. I think it's actually quite the opposite. It feels like getting an update would probably be more of a sign of good news, unless that news was JOK's retiring from football. But if you're going to get an update in this case, it feels much more likely that you're going to get a, hey, you know, maybe we don't have a timetable, but he's trending really far upward, and we probably expect him to get on the field, you know, sometime next year. That would be the update. This is, hey, I mean, he's getting back to doing physical activity. We saw him show up to the Browns facilities and go through and at least participate in, I don't know if it was meetings or a workout at that point, but he was there. He showed up and he was there. I mean, you saw him moving. You saw him in the flesh. It helped. But yeah, by no means is this a guarantee we're going to see something just miraculous this year. I think the signs were all the other way, and we should have been picking up on those. Should not be a surprising move, and of course, we're hoping for the best for JOK. I mean, that would be not only for the football aspect of it, but obviously the person. Let's keep a little more Browns talk going here. Scott Petrak, Browns.com, BrownZone.com, on with Baskin and Phelps today, and he was asked Hey, as you look at the rookie quarterbacks here after rookie minicamp, who do you give the edge to? And he took his pick.
You know, I like Sanders coming out of the draft more than I like Gabriel. That didn't change over these two practices. Sanders is bigger and thicker. I think he throws it plenty well enough. Gabriel throws a tighter spiral more consistently, I would say, than Sanders does. Some of those shorter passes, Sanders can throw some wobblers, and you saw it at the Colorado Pro Day. Just watching on TV, you could see that. But he also threw some really good deep balls that he throws with enough zip on some of those intermediate passes. So I thought Sanders threw it well enough. I thought Gabriel threw it well enough. You know, if I were going to give it a slight edge, I'd probably go Sanders from the 2 days, but I don't think it was significant. I thought both looked like, just from a throwing standpoint, they both looked like they belong in the NFL.
I think that probably a good sign for Browns fans. I think we all probably would have expected Shador to be at least slightly in the lead and looking like the better quarterback based on where we all projected him, based on where he fell. But you're not going to find that much out from rookie minicamp. We talked about it. Like, we're obviously going to go through, maybe overanalyze some throws, maybe talk about a little bit too much that we shouldn't. But at the end of the day, you don't learn very much from rookie minicamp, certainly not as a fan. Do the teams learn something? Yeah, probably a little bit. But us as fans don't really learn that much. We get to watch these guys throw in the colors that they're hopefully wearing for the next 4+ years. But ultimately, you just don't learn that much. I like Shador having the slight edge. I like that. Oh, a lot of the videos that I saw coming out of Shador from the Browns threw a really nice back shoulder touchdown pass to now Browns wide receiver Luke Floria. But again, you just don't see that much. There's nothing that was of crazy interest to me throughout this entire thing that happened on the course of play. And it's just, all right, basically on to the next. Now, I'd love if this was the standalone, everybody had this take, but then you get to Daryl Ryder, our very own Cleveland sports beat reporter, who was on with Ken and Anthony this morning. He asked, who do you give the edge to? And Daryl went the opposite direction.
I can see why they drafted both of these kids. Both of them made positive first impressions, so I don't want this to come off that I'm hating on Shador Sanders, because apparently if you say anything negative about Shador, all of a sudden you're hating on the young man, which I don't get, but it, you know, that's the day and age we live in. Dylan's throws have a little more zip to them than Shador's do. Both quarterbacks are extremely accurate, which is obviously a really, really good thing, but I feel like Dylan's get there with a little more oomph on them and a little quicker. So that's why I give him a very slight edge, but it's not much.
I feel like every single person that I saw break this down, and this is where I sort of lose my mind, every person breaking it down has a different storyline of where they view the quarterbacks, right? We had Scott Petrak be like, slight edge to Sanders. Daryl saying slight edge to Dylan Gabriel. I have Zach Jackson of The Athletic telling me it's Shador and it's not close. How can we all watch the same videos and come up with a different analysis? Oh, that's right, because they're throwing with no shoulder pads, with no pants, basically against a ghost of a defense. Guys, you're not going to get true analysis. Anywhere where we look and you go, slight edge maybe over to this guy, you just don't know. That is the main takeaway that we should be having from a rookie minicamp. You just don't know. Because there's no shot that I have people going slight lean to Dylan Gabriel, and I have massive, not even close, Shador Sanders is in the lead. And I'm not saying that any one of those guys is wrong. It's just that you really don't know. I'm going to guess that Zach Jackson probably thought Shador should have been in the lead. Probably had a lot of his biases confirmed by what he saw on the tape. I know that Daryl, well, not a hater of Shador Sanders in any way, but I don't think he was his biggest fan either. Also, probably had some biases confirmed where it's like, oh, well, I see that Dylan Gabriel's ball looks faster. So that's a slight edge to the point of Gabriel, because we know that the arm talent and the arm power maybe not necessarily there for Shador Sanders. It's just the pre-existing biases confirmed in this. It's all it does. You're just getting random video, and I mean, for obviously the people reporting on it here, they were live in person and got to see the throws. But it's the same thing. You're just now analyzing the same exact thing that all of us are doing. And guys, there were good throws by both sides. There were bad throws by both sides. In fact, Coach Reyes, Lance Reisland, shot me a text earlier on in the show that was like, here's a video of every throw Shador made. And I think he put it up on X as well. And he was like, good throws, bad throws. Ultimately, you learn nothing. And he's right. Coach Riss is right. You just learn nothing. All of these guys are going to go through. If you decided who your quarterback was in a quarterback competition in May, I'd call you a moron. And I'd be dooming the Cleveland Browns for this entire season. I don't have to do that. They've practically led themselves down a road of being doomed anyway this year. But they're not going to decide the quarterback here. And they're not going to know who's the better player. Wait until their shoulder pads on. Wait until the defense isn't afraid to get into the mix. And wait until you actually face off against a team that isn't your own team. That isn't other rookies that the Browns brought in for tryouts. And then we might learn a little bit something else. Other than that, you've been watching the exact same thing that you've been watching on tape, at Pro Days, and everything else. It's just a whole lot of hoopla. That's where we're going. All right, let's close things out here. Danny Cunningham, you can find him on the Inside Shot Substack. You can find him on Locked On Cavs and occasionally on the station. On with Afternoon Drive today and was asked, series over?
I do not think they're going to come back and win, but it's not over. There are avenues to get this done because I do think if you want to be optimistic, and again, I'm not saying this is going to happen. I would not bet on this to happen. But if you want to be optimistic, I do think that you can talk yourself into, well, the Cavs have to make shots at some point. They've been the worst three-point shooting team in this round of the playoffs after being the second-best three-point shooting team in basketball all year. I think it's extremely unlikely considering how beat up this Cavs team is. And not only the loss that they had on Sunday, which obviously very demoralizing, as you can imagine. It was a very, very quiet locker room last night in Gainbridge Fieldhouse, but also the loss they had in game two.
Yeah, guys, again, I'm looking at a 3-1 series deficit and going, man, you're never going to count a team out. And especially a team, the one seed is the Cavs that played as well as they did all year. But also, they're about as close to counted out as that can get. I'm giving you small chance. If you just had played absolutely abysmal and Indiana had looked mundane and was just winning games, I'd give you a shot. Indiana has gone nuclear in this series, and the Cavs have shrunk to the size of a mouse. And you are on both sides of the spectrum when it comes to the play in the playoffs that you can get to, and the Cavs are on the wrong end of it. And I think it's too difficult to ask a team like this to just make the jump. To go from playing so poorly for the course of four games and then instantly in the flip of a switch, get back to playing at the top level. We saw them do it from the end of the regular season over to playing Miami. Let's all be real. We knew Miami was a team waiting to roll over. That team was more excited for Cancun than they were to play in the first round of the NBA playoffs. I think they shocked themselves by making the playoffs. Nobody believed that they could make it. We all know that. We know it to be true. And you ended up with the spot that they're in now. I don't think that Miami's banking on anything going well there. And then the Cavs faced a legitimate playoff team. And they got cold at the wrong time. Hadn't seen the premier defense probably for a good portion of the year. And probably got a false sense of security and a lot of injuries mixed in as well. But it's just what you have. If you're going to make a difference, you have to show up like the Cavs that showed up to start the season. You got to show up like the Cavs who went on a separate 15-game win streak. You can't just lounge around and miss shots all day, play lackadaisical defense, and expect to get there. The Cavs have to find a way to get hungry again. And they have to find a way to turn that hunger into a product. All right, that'll do it for the Station Buzz. Coming back here in 5 minutes. Guardians, winners over the Brewers at home. 5-0. We'll react to it with the old classic 3-and-out. It's overtime with Jake Volnick with you guys right here on The Fan.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
This is Free Range with Von Miller, the podcast where I step outside the lines and I take you with me. Each week, we're talking everything from the biggest stories around the league to the biggest stories off the field. This isn't your average sports podcast. This is game meets culture, locker room meets living room, and no topic is off limits. So if you're into good conversations that ruffle a few feathers, join me every Wednesday and follow Free Range with Von Miller everywhere you get your podcasts.